This is the Scorebook Alive Today podcast. It's Thursday, October 10th. It's week six of the high school football season in Washington. And today I'm joined by analyst, columnist, former NBA player, and All-American Dan Dickow in Spokane coming off Scorebook Alive's inaugural basketball media day, and reporter Todd Millis in Tacoma. Dan, it snowed this week, and you're talking basketball. What's going on in Spokane?
You got me there. I have no idea. Yesterday, there was the schools in the Spokane School District, District 81, did not have school. There was almost 5 inches of snow on October 9th at the Spokane Airport. There were down trees everywhere, so there was no snow, no school. But yes, you're right. We had our first media day. It encompassed schools in the GSL and the GNL here on the east side of the state. Really getting ready and gearing up for basketball season. We're going to have a number of these on the west side coming up in the next few weeks where we can dive in and hear more about the programs and the players and the coaches and the philosophies leading into this next basketball season. So really excited about what we're doing there.
Just going to give a quick rundown of the podcast today off the top. We're going to talk about the top five athletes currently playing high school football. Todd put together a nice story on that is have a ton of questions about, and going to break down some headlines from around the state and then take a quick break. And after the break, we will preview the biggest, most anticipated high school football game in Washington of the regular season, Eastside Catholic versus O'Day. But first, the top five athletes currently playing high school football in the state of Washington. Todd, you wrote that story last week on scorebooklive.com/Washington. I've been fascinated by the names on that list. There's certainly, I'm sure it was hard to pin it down to just five. So, I mean, how did you construct the criteria, and how the heck did you narrow it down to five guys?
Yeah, quite frankly, I didn't have much criteria, if you want to know the truth. I called the guy I trust most in football talent evaluation, Brandon Huffman, who, you know, I've worked with. It's a thing called Super Prep Magazine. I'm at the ocean. We have marine air down here, so it's a little slower for the brain to work down here by the ocean. Super Prep Magazine in the 1990s and early 2000s. At that point, he was covering California. I was doing all the Washington recruiting, and so I mean, he does this for a living. And so when we talked, I mean, like you said, there are hundreds of fantastic athletes, especially athletes from different sports, playing football. How do you narrow it down to five? That was the best way for me to try and figure out five names and then their best discernible skill. So thanks and a shout out to Brandon for his honesty and his astute evaluation. And not surprisingly, you know, four of the names are four of the biggest recruits in the state. We had JT Tuamalo, the defensive lineman from Eastside Catholic. We had G. Scott, who's a fantastic receiver, Ohio State commit. Emeka Agbuka from Stellicum. The one name that I hadn't heard much of was a name that Brandon knew, and he broke it down. His name's Josh Connerly, and I wanted to highlight him. And you know why Josh Connerly over some of these other linemen? And it's a really good crop of linemen here over the next 3 years around the state, especially young linemen. And he said because Josh was a former running back, his speed and most importantly his footwork and his hand speed. Now you think about that, athleticism, hand speed. He thinks those two things, footwork and hand speed, separate Josh from the other really, really good linemen. And right after we talked, then the scholarship offers came in. Tennessee, Oregon. It sounds like Rainier Beach has a pretty special young man up there on his offensive line. He's only a sophomore. So he made our top five. It was kind of a fun list. I mean, I'm sure if Dan did a top five and you did a top five, Andy, and other media outlets did a top five, I'm sure we'd come up with, five different names. It's not a definitive list, but it's a list that I'm proud of and really proud that my friend Brandon Huffman had some contribution to.
You know, I love the couple of the comments that you made there that, you know, footwork and hand speed. So many times people look at athleticism as maybe just being the ability to sprint in a straight line fast, or a basketball player jumps really high, or a football player very powerful. And yeah, those things are very important. But athleticism, to me, honestly, touches so many things. It's your balance. It's your footwork. It's your spatial recognition of are you able to get into a gap quickly or out of a gap. It's being able to have enough strength, but the right strength when you get hit, stay on balance. It's the hand-eye coordination. So many things go into it. And so I think this is going to be a really fun article to really kind of dive in and read. So I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Todd, when you talk about Rainier Beach's lineman, Josh Connerly, who is now 6'6", 275, and you describe all of his attributes and the fact that he used to play running back, I mean, it reminds me of those players in basketball who you know, grew up playing guard and were always small, and then essentially hit a huge growing spurt in high school or at some point, and all of a sudden they're this big man with guard skills. So it's when you look at athlete, I mean, that's someone, it feels like he kind of embodies that.
Yeah, I've seen a lot with tight ends that grow to be offensive tackles. I know Washington State was big on recruiting high school tight ends and trying to bulk them up because of, you know, like Dan said, spatial awareness, footwork, and you just throw 40, 50 pounds on them and make them a tackle. I know that was a big philosophy with Washington State. I'm sure others have done that as well. But running back, you think about that, a running back going to the offensive line, that's one I hadn't heard before. So you're right. It's kind of like that guard that grows up to be a power forward. He has grown up. It's funny because I talked to Corey Sampson about that transition, and it wasn't a transition he welcomed. He wanted to, you know, he wanted to stay running back. And they said, well, okay, when you come in as a ninth grader, you know, we'll move you to tight end. We'll move you where you're still going to catch the ball. You're going to still have your hands on the football. And so he said, okay, we'll play tight end. And then after a little bit of that, it was like, yeah, you're going to be a lineman. And at that point, I think he kind of saw his fate, and look at it, it's paid dividends. You know, he's collected a few Division I scholarships. Again, only a sophomore, so he's part of that young group of really good class of 2022 offensive linemen around the state. And when it's all said and done, he could be the best of them.
Sure. Yeah. And a school at Rainier Beach that, you may be able to describe as having kind of a down year and could be on the upswing by the time it's all said and done in his high school career. So after we're going to talk a little bit about some headlines across the state. And just kind of to jump things off, there were a couple of basketball commitments this week. Federal Way's Kendall Munson, a forward, I believe a three-star, committed to Pepperdine. Liam Lloyd, Gonzaga Prep sharpshooter, commits to Grand Canyon. A couple of guys who have made a presence, established themselves on the high school basketball scene across the state. They commit. They're going to be playing at the next level. What did you make of these commitments? I know, Todd, you wrote up a story on Kendall that's on the site right now.
Well, Kendall Munson, you mentioned Federal Way. He actually started at Puyallup and then was going to go to Rainier Beach, and now he's at Garfield with Brandon Roy coming back. So, it's been a really interesting year. He was at a Christian school in Sacramento for a couple years and came back to the area and had a fantastic year at Puyallup. Was a first team all SBSL, all four A SBSL forward, and then led Puyallup to the state championships where they finished sixth. It was their best finish in a long time. They say he's 6'8". He's probably closer to 6'5", 6'6". He needs to probably improve his range a little bit. But he's a really powerful guy in the pivot and around the paint. you know, he's just a little undersized. I know Washington State were early in on him, had offered, but it kind of came down to a few of the WCC schools, which I think is a really good level for him. And so he decided he was going to wait on his birthday, an interesting one. You know how kids in their presentation, when they, you know, when it's time to announce, he put a lot of emphasis on 18th birthday, midnight, I'm going to announce. And that's what he did on Instagram, and said he was going to choose Pepperdine and Lorenzo Omar, making him the first Washington high school player to go to Lorenzo since Lorenzo returned to Pepperdine here a few years ago.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting how he chose to do it at midnight on his birthday, because I did see the same thing, that an announcement was coming. I'll be honest, I wasn't staying up till midnight, but congratulations to Kendall Munson. You know, I had a chance to watch him closely at WIBCA this summer, and what I saw is, you know, somebody with a pretty big upside. I think there's a lot to work with as far as potential. I think he's got good hands. I think his footwork is okay. But athletically, I think is what, you know, is it makes him an intriguing prospect. I would agree with you that, you know, size wise, would have probably been a difficult ask for him at the Pac-12 level. But I think he's found a good home at Pepperdine with Coach Romar. I think he's got a chance if he develops some of his offensive skills, because at this point, I think he's mostly a rebounder, shot blocker, and a dive guy to be able to finish around the rim or finish off of offensive rebounds. But, you know, you get him around a great coaching staff in college, he could expand his game and have a nice college career. But I thought it was great to see Lorenzo back up in the Northwest recruiting in an area that he's very well respected and he knows a lot of people. So I thought that was great for both.
Second commitment came over the weekend. Liam Lloyd, Gonzaga prep sharpshooter, someone who I know we've seen a lot of. I certainly haven't. I haven't been covering him the last few years, but he was a part of a big part of Gonzaga Prep's repeat 4A state championship this year with Anton Watson. What did you guys make of him committing to Grand Canyon?
I wasn't surprised at all. I was surprised that he committed so early. You know, I know the family well, just because Tommy was an assistant coach at Gonzaga when I played there, and Tommy's his dad. So I kind of knew what he was thinking as far as looking for in a college. You know, and I think the biggest reason why is there's such an emphasis on at Grand Canyon of being a great program and having a great environment, and basketball is a big thing. That was so appealing to Liam, because he's grown up around the Gonzaga basketball program, where you have the Kennel Club, and Gonzaga basketball is the biggest thing in town. You know, Grand Canyon basketball is not the biggest thing in Phoenix, but on campus, it's a very big thing. And I think that's what Liam was looking for. You know, as far as it being an early commitment, that's where I think I was maybe a little surprised, because I had the chance to sit down and interview Liam yesterday at our GSL media day. And that was the first visit and the only visit that he has taken. He had a couple others that he was going to take. And if he didn't like any of them, he even mentioned, hey, he would have had interest in going the prep school route and seeing where his recruitment led in another year. So I think the fact that he was aggressively recruited by Grand Canyon, he went down there on a visit, he really enjoyed it, he saw where he could fit in, and he saw the emphasis that that school and program puts on having it be a great environment was something that really sold Liam on going to Grand Canyon.
Dan, I'm wondering, you mentioned a good fit in that offense. I mean, can you, for our listeners, about what Dan Marley does with his offense and where you see him fitting in that offense, why it's such a good fit for him?
Well, I think the why it's a good fit is so many times as a player, when you're looking at colleges, or if you're, say, an NBA free agent, you want to look at if the coach was a former player, what kind of player were they, and what kind of values did they bring to the game. And you look at Liam, the first strength that jumps out at him, he can shoot the ball. Okay, so you're probably going to want to find a coaching staff and a head coach that values shooting the ball. Well, what did Dan Majerle do in the NBA? He was a great three-point shooter. So you would imagine that his structure and his offensive philosophy is going to be built around shooting the basketball and taking advantage of having good shooters on the floor, spacing it, and shooting a lot of threes. Now, I haven't seen Grand Canyon play in person, but I do know that they value shooters. They space the floor. They shoot a lot of threes. They want to play up-tempo. And so that's why I think Liam was such a high-priority target for them.
And a program that's certainly on the rise. I mean, relatively new to Division I and being in the WAC, their recruiting has continued to rise in its profile. So we'll be interested to see how Liam fits into that system and fits into the rise of that program down there. The third news item today, we'll break a little news on this podcast. I'm not sure if by the time this you're hearing this, this will be out by now, but some news at the state level regarding the Gridiron Classic, which we've talked about in recent weeks. The Gridiron Classic, as you guys know, is headed outside. It's breaking tradition from the 40 years it's been indoors. It's been in the Tacoma Dome since the 90s, and it'll be at three sites across the Tacoma area, all outdoor sites. The WIA and Root Sports were in kind of negotiations to televise those games outdoors at the time of the announcement and the board approval on those sites. But right now, the association and Root Sports have agreed in principle to the 2A and 3A games being televised live. So this will be the first year that the Regional Sports Network will broadcast the 2A state title game. It's not a stranger to games at the 2A level. They've broadcast 2A games in the regular season before, but the 3A, 4A games used to be the games being broadcast. It was because they were in the same place. And now the WIA felt that the 3A, 4A games were not a good fit to be in the same place due to various circumstances. And the Root Sports operation could only accommodate broadcasting games at one location. So the 2A, 3A games will be televised. What did you guys make of kind of this news and maybe what that means for folks who are fans at the 4A level who are going to have to, you know, if they're going to want to see the game, they're going to have to go out and go.
I think it's an interesting decision that the largest school classification is not going to be one of the games that's broadcast. Obviously, they had to pick a site and somebody was going to get left out. And, you know, the fact that the Seattle Metro is predominantly or is actually a 3A league because of, you know, the student enrollment at those schools. And quite possibly they've got the best teams and the best players right now. So Root Sports has decided to go to that level, to that title game. And then the 2A, because of location, gets kind of lumped into it. So, you know, I get it. You can't be in all places at all times. And with the inability to have the title games all at the Tacoma Dome, this was a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, it's great for 2A. I mean, it would have even been better if Sawyer Racanelli was playing and people around the state would have had a chance to possibly watch him if Hawkinson had gotten that far. There's some really good players at the 2A level, and we mentioned one of them, Mecca Agbuka, earlier in the podcast. My only question is, it's almost like these things have sort of gotten out of sorts. Like if the TV contract, it seems like maybe the TV contract before you announce the sites, maybe the TV contract should have been secure. The negotiations should have been secure. Now I understand that, you know, the reason they didn't couple 4A and 3A together was a crowd control and a crowd flow. And they didn't think, but, you know, noon and four hours would be enough to get, you know, the first game crowd in and out and the second game crowd, you know, in. And I guess my question to the WIA would have been, why not, if it was your two TV games, why not start an hour earlier? Why not have it at 11? Or why not start an hour later? Why not put a little more time in between those two games if you've still valued televising two games and the games that you traditionally televised on Friday and Saturday nights in the Tacoma Dome? I mean, as we know, and what's developed in 4A, there are six or seven. It's probably the most suspenseful classification, I think, in the state this year. There are six, seven teams that can go win this thing, including Kennedy Catholic, which has, you know, the same type of name recognition as Eastside Catholic with Sam Heward and Junior Alexander and Savelle Smalls. I mean, if they get on TV and you're not televising them, you know, and you've traditionally done that, it's a bit of a peculiar decision. I'm not saying it's the wrong decision. I mean, I'm you know, the positive is that there's going to be two state championship games on TV, where I think in the previous weeks we all kind of feared it was just going to be one. It was going to be 3A or 4A. So the fact that they're going to televise two games is heartening, but to not have the 4A game on TV, man, that's a tough one to swallow. And I like Dan said, I think there's going to be some real loud voices, you know, protesting this decision on not having the largest school classification represented at Gridiron Classic.
Sure, and this is the decision that is still, you know, it still has not been officially confirmed. Both sides, at least I heard from the WIA, the folks there had said that, you know, neither side is really worried at this point. It's just they've agreed in principle and they're waiting for, you know, the deal to be officially set in stone. But in the decision-making process, as the association was working out all of these three sites, which was led by John Miller, who was an assistant executive director who retired back in June, but had been working on this kind of post Tacoma Dome option for, you know, more than a year. The association said that, you know, yeah, their Root Sports' preference would have been to televise the 3A 4A game, but the association didn't feel, again, that they could logistically accommodate the 3A and 4A in one site with a 12 p.m. game and a 4 p.m. game. So at this point, you know, Root Sports has got to be looking at it and saying, okay, well, you know, the WIA comes to us and says, here's what we've got. We've got these two games. Do you want them? And Root Sports, you know, said yes. So it's certainly something that, like you guys said, expecting to, you know, hear some strong reactions, especially as it gets closer to the games and these issues. I mean, which are still – there's still so much football to be played, but they won't be front of mind, I feel like, until that week. So we're going to take a quick break, but after the break, Todd and I are going to discuss the biggest game of the regular season, which takes place Friday, Eastside Catholic, O'Day. A nationally relevant game, so stay tuned.
Washington Federal is a bank based in Seattle that operates 235 branches, and it cares deeply about high school sports not only in the Seattle metro area, but across the entire state of Washington. Head to WashingtonFederal.com to learn more or visit your closest branch.
We are back. I'm on the line with Todd Millis. We are going to talk Eastside Catholic O'Day football, a game that, Todd, both you and I are going to be at, and one that for these two teams who have been consensus number one and two all season at the 3A level, it's kind of been a collision course toward this rematch since last December when the two teams played in the 3A state title game. And Eastside Catholic, you know, really brought it to O'Day. What do you make of this matchup? And do you think that O'Day is going to, with that defense and that discipline under Monty Kohler, is going to be able to slow down Eastside and their dynamic offense?
Well, let's go back to last year. And O'Day played Eastside Catholic as tough as any team in the state. And still, it was a few touchdowns in each game. O'Day had 19 All-Metro seniors on that team that lost by a few touchdowns in both of those games, including the 3A championship game. Now, 19 of those All-League seniors are gone. And this Eastside Catholic group is now the ones that we talk about. We can go through them. DJ Rogers, Sam Adams, G. Scott, Aiden Hector. They've got a new quarterback from, Logan Muasau. That's how you pronounce it. It's even there's a pronunciation guide on their roster. Is the new quarterback, the transfer from Hawaii. This is their year. If O'Day is going to even keep this game close, the one neutralizing advantage that O'Day has is they have a fantastic front on both sides. They have Jalen Dixon, and they have Owen Prentice, who might be the best lineman in the state, if you want to know the truth. He's such a great athlete. He has a rugby background. He plays guard. He plays inside. On the defensive line. So that's where O'Day can give Eastside Catholic the most fits. I don't think Eastside Catholic can just overpower O'Day's front. My biggest question is, if Eastside Catholic gets off to a fast start, can O'Day pass the ball enough, and that wing T is not really set up to throw out of. And so can those quarterbacks at O'Day, Milton Hopkins, find a way to complete some passes and keep drives alive? He certainly has a weapon on the outside in David Patu, who's a dynamic punt returner, kickoff returner, playmaker, receiver. So they have a guy that they can get the ball to and make things happen. But if Eastside Catholic gets off to a fast start and they're already up two touchdowns in the first quarter or first half, how does O'Day counter? And that's the biggest question on whether this is a competitive game or not. O'Day has had some close games early. If you look at it, Bethel, Peninsula was close to even for a while. They've played their best football here the last couple weeks. In league. I personally don't see this game being all that close. Could it be sort of like last year? I think it has a chance to be kind of a 40-14, 40-20 type game. I just think Eastside Catholic, this is that group's year. And there's going to be a lot of tension. It's Eastside Catholic's going to be hyper focused. They're at home tomorrow night. I mean, on the schedule, this is the game that everybody wants, and everybody wants to see. It's getting national acclaim, but on the football field, X's and O's, with the kind of firepower that Eastside Catholic has on offense, I don't see it being very close.
Yeah, and last week, Todd, you were at the Eastside Garfield game, which Garfield put two or three touchdowns on the Crusaders, and I was at the game early in the season when Eastside went down to Oregon and played Central Catholic, and Central Catholic scored the first two touchdowns of the game. They returned the opening kick to the house. But whenever Eastside wants to turn it on, I think you described it in your story last week as a fire hose, and that's, it's an apt comparison because there's so many weapons on offense. And I asked Monty Kohler about that yesterday. How do you even approach stopping an offense like that? And he's like, well, we're thinking about sending 12 or 13 guys out on defense. And obviously he was joking, but that's kind of the approach. He says, if we guess wrong and they guess right, it's a big play for them. It's just as simple as that. There's no room for error. Will O'Day be able to keep it close? That's kind of going to be the big framing question around this game. Kind of some interesting background on these two coaches. I wrote a story that's now, as we're recording this, live on scorebooklive.com/Washington. Obviously the Eastside O'Day rivalry goes back years. They're two Catholic schools. Both are regionally relevant. Eastside's now nationally relevant. This is a game that USA Today tabs as one of the top high school football games across the entire country this week. Monty Kohler is no stranger to the big stage. He's been a head coach at O'Day now for 30. He's in his 35th year. He's the winningest active coach in the state. And that tracks back to when Dom Dasty, the first-year head coach and first-time head coach at Eastside Catholic, was a lineman at the University of Washington. His roommate was a former O'Day standout and a guy by the name of Kyle Benn, who played on the line with Dasty at the University of Washington. And so Dasty, who's from the Los Angeles area, he, you know, as young as college, he heard about this Monty Kohler and this O'Day football program. And so, you know, 20 years later, of course, over the years, Dasty went through the college coaching ranks at Montana, you know, made stops at UNLV and just recruiting the Northwest. Kohler is a name that he was aware of, but they met for the first time kind of officially last spring, and it was at Eastside Catholic, and Kohler was there. It just happened to be there for his son's JV lacrosse game. You know, it was a spring evening, and you know, he's walking in and Dassey's walking out, and they just happened to run into each other, and it's, you know, here are these two head coaches, and Kohler just kind of wished him well, and he said, you know, I just said, if you need me to help you in any way, I'll do it. I'm not going to help you beat us, because, you know, he certainly doesn't need any help. But, you know, it's kind of an interesting crash course between two teams that are no stranger to each other as opponents.
Yeah, and, you know, you talked about these two coaches themselves, and that's great stuff on the background stuff there, Andy. You know, Dom's a lot more like Monty. He lets kind of the actions do the talking. They're both, you know, kind of reserved guys. If people who know Monty, you might meet Monty and you might sort of feel like, you know, he's kind of blowing you off. He's kind of old school, but you play for Monty, you won't hear a guy that's played for Monty that doesn't love the man. I mean, he is as loyal as they come. He would do anything for his players. He would do anything for his coaches and players and staff members that have gone to, you know, to battle, so to speak, for him in O'Day football. And I think Dom's a little more like that. You know, Jeremy Theobar, the former Eastside Catholic coach, was a fiery, outspoken, you know, borderline cocky personality, and clashed with not only Monty, but with a few other coaches around the state. Now, for our purposes, Jeremy was great. He'd tell you stuff. But Dom's brought a little more of the let's just keep it to football stuff to the program this year. And the one thing that I noticed last week in a game that could have gotten out of hand from a personality standpoint, and I'm talking about the talking and the antics and things, never really reached inflammatory. I mean, there was some talking between the two Metro League schools, with both of them with great athletes, but by and large, you know, they just played football. And I think that's the Dom Dasty influence this year. And I think that's the part of the program that I think Monty can really respect, because, you know, Monty doesn't stand for that sort of stuff. And so from that standpoint, I think it's a, you know, those two coaches should get along for a while, as long as, and we all know Monty's going to be there. Monty's going to break all the coaching records. He's not that far away. He's probably 5 or 6 years away from eclipsing Sid Otten as the all-time winningest coach in state history. And there's no reason for Monty to step away that we know of. And it sounds like Dom wants to be there for a while after being an assistant under Jeremy, and he's hired his staff and he wants to see this through, and this good young talent that he has. And it's going to be a fascinating game from that standpoint. But from where they are right now, from Eastside Catholic has so many seniors who are accomplished, who've won games at the national level. And this O'Day group is largely inexperienced other than those linemen. And that, you know, in a game like this, O'Day will be – they'll play disciplined, and Monty will have his guys ready. But at the end of the day, I just think Eastside Catholic has too much firepower.
No question. And something interesting that that Dasty brought up, that he kind of felt like you know, rivalries like this have changed in kind of the new age of social media and how high school football, the landscape has shifted. Like, we're at a point now where a lot of these Eastside Catholic players, when they line up against their rival, they're lining up against guys they know, guys they played with, friends of theirs, people who they're familiar with. And so it wasn't like 20, 30 years ago where you play the team across town and there's a lot of fire that goes into those matchups. And, there's guys that you might not know on a personal level. So certainly a game where these guys are certainly familiar with each other beyond just the football field.
Yeah, and as we – and this kind of kicks off our, over the next 3 weeks, number one team in the state versus number two team in the state. And that's what I love about high school football. And we go back to our preseason rankings. These are the top two teams who not only finished last season, but were, the consensus top two teams in 3A. It's nice to see that they continue to play out that way. This far into the regular season, and there's a very, 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 very good chance that we could see these two teams playing in Puyallup in December as well. But like I said, this kicks off our ones versus two. Next week we have Napa Vine and Onalaska, two league rivals down there in Southwest Washington at the 2B level, and they're both undefeated going into this week. And then the following week, the class of BA football, and I don't even think it's close after those two teams. Amara Cooley Heartline and Odessa play, and I don't suspect that either one of those teams are going to lose here in the next couple of weeks.
No, and that's a great point, Todd. And if you are a fan of high school football in the state of Washington, and for whatever reason you haven't, really been as tuned in up until now is the time, because these games are going to start, and it's really going to be a launching pad into the playoff picture, and when games start to really mean more. So now is the time where things across the state are going to really start heating up, and the next 3 weeks there's at least one really, really good top tier matchup. So thanks for listening today. If you like what we do, if you care about high school football, if you want to hear more about it week in and week out, storylines across the state, head to Apple Podcasts, rate us, review us, subscribe for free so you get every one of these episodes each Wednesday, Thursday on your phone. It'll download immediately for free. We're also on anywhere else you get your podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, you name it. So thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back next week with a new episode of the Scorebook Live Today podcast.